Now, our first panelist is the Honorable Paul Findlay. Congressman Findlay is a member of the House of Representatives serving Illinois since 1960. He's a member of the House Committee on Agriculture and Foreign Affairs and has served as chairman of the House Committee on Western Alliances. Congressman Findlay has been a delegate to the North Atlantic Assembly in Brussels and to the 11th and 12th NATO Parliamentarian Conference. He is the author of The Federal Farm Fable and has an impressive list of honors and service to various organizations. It isn't often that I give such a glowing introduction to a well-known card-carrying Republican, but I'm happy to do it today in friendship and in the spirit of comity and amity.
I congratulate these distinguished governors on selecting the world food crisis as the topic for today's agenda, because the challenge of feeding the world's expanding population is indeed formidable, and it deserves the attention of all thoughtful citizens. The American people will, I am sure, respond to the challenge with substantial aid for both famine relief and for famine prevention in the years ahead, just as they have in the past. I don't think any panel members will disagree on that point. The central question we ought to deal with is this: can the American people do a still better job in meeting this challenge, and if so, how? And even more fundamental to that, what should be the relationship of the federal government to these activities? My suggestions are these. First of all, concerning famine relief, I recommend a change in Public Law 480, the Food for Peace program, so that donations of grain for famine relief can occur legally, regardless of whether the grain involved happens to be in surplus position or not. Under the present PL 480 law, the Secretary of Agriculture technically cannot authorize donations for famine relief unless that he finds that these commodities are not required for dollar sales or for any domestic purpose. And the present low level of stocks makes these conditions, for the very first time in the history of PL 480, important. Our experience with famine relief shows that on an average, $300 million a year in donations is required. And I recommend that this sum be appropriated annually for famine relief with authority to the Secretary to acquire the stocks, the supplies, as market and famine conditions might warrant. This change will establish a famine relief grain reserve upon which stricken areas can depend. With this change, no one can properly charge that the charitable instincts of the U.S. government are only surplus deep. And this famine relief reserve, I strongly believe, is the only grain reserve our federal government should establish at this time. I note that a resolution will be taken up by the governors tomorrow recommending government grain reserves, and I hope the governors will take a close look at it before making a final decision. Concerning famine prevention, I propose that the American people, acting through their governors and the state legislatures, as well as the Congress and the executive branch of the federal government, adopt a long-term program that our own experience proves to be sound. Let us invest in the education of farmers in these developing food deficit countries. And I'm not talking about the short-term, broadside technical assistance programs of the past and the present. Over the past century, our state governments, working closely with the federal government, have adopted in this nation the finest agricultural support system the world has ever known, the system of land-grant colleges of agriculture, through which the highly skilled profession of food production has been established and constantly improved over the years. Nowhere else, Nowhere else is the vocation of agriculture so exalted and so successful as here in this country. And much of the credit for this belongs to the land grant system, which involves classroom training of farmers, extension training of farmers out in the field, as well as research directed to the local needs and requirements. And in my view, the greatest contribution that the American people could make to prevent world famine would be to help these developing countries establish their own land grant system through which each can build its own reliable and progressive food production system. It will require patience. It will require patience over a long period of time. It will require commitment. But based on our own experience here in this country, it will work. And for this purpose, I recommend that the federal government, with the cooperation, of course, of the governors and state legislatures, convert the resources of the foreign aid program into long-term contracts for agricultural education abroad. Let me illustrate how this would work. Under a typical contract, the College of Agriculture of the University of Minnesota or the College of Agriculture of the University of Illinois would be given 10 years, a 10-year contract, during which time it would help India, for example, to establish, to organize, and to staff a land-grant type agricultural educational institution, one complete with classroom extension and research services. I pick India for no particular reason except that it illustrates the need for this type agricultural support system. India has the rainfall, it has the soil, it has the climate to produce enough food for twice the present population of India. There is no doubt about it. That's well established. All that India needs is well-trained, well-motivated farmers who are equipped with the right tools. And given those tools, given that motivation, India can provide for its own food needs. Investment in agricultural education makes sense abroad as it does here at home. This program will not have the excitement and the drama of shiploads of donated wheat streaming endlessly day after day to a food deficit country. But in time, it will build the foundation for successful and enduring self-help on the part of the needy countries. Instead of creating dependency and, in a sense, despondency, as often occurs when handouts get to be a habit, this program will build self-sufficiency as well as self-respect. And in the long term, it will help the developing countries become good customers for American products of all kinds, including food products. Properly handled and coordinated with education and population control, land-grant education can prevent famine worldwide. And I believe it can accomplish this vital goal within our lifetime. These comments are on the positive side, and now just a few words of warning about some of the proposals that have been made and perhaps will be made concerning the world food situation. First of all, it seems to me that Washington and perhaps other parts of the country are on a government grain stockpile kick that, to say the least, is premature. What is needed today is food production by the private sector and not supply management grain stockpiling by the government. Our Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, I think deserves a rousing cheer for turning loose the maximum production capacity of all of the cropland of this nation. He would have done it sooner had the public law permitted this to be done. But even this year, we might recall when for the first time in 20 years, all of our cropland has been available for planting without restriction. Doleful voices complained that this action would produce a glut and warned our department against taking that action. So I think at this conference, On world food supply, Mr. Butts deserves credit for putting first things first, that is, getting full production underway. For the first time in many years, the federal government is substantially out of the grain business. And for the first time in a long time, grain prices and therefore farm income are about the best they have been since the early 50s. And this departure of the U.S. government from the grain business has naturally caused some adjustment problems. For many years, private interests, a notable example is the baking industry here in this country, as well as certain foreign countries, have relied upon the U.S. government for warehousing services. It's been an unnatural arrangement, but it has persisted for a long period of time, and naturally these private interests, as well as these foreign countries, have gotten adjusted to it. They've come to depend upon the U.S. government. But the years of brimful CCC bins certainly caused the warehousing facilities in the non-CCC area to atrophy. Now, what's going to happen? We've had a rather bruising transition period, but I believe the worst is over. I'm confident that private interests, including farmers, as well as foreign countries, will expand their warehouse facilities. That is, they'll do their own stockpiling once they are convinced that the U.S. government will stay out of the warehouse business. The private sector will respond as it already is beginning to respond in other ways too. I predict, for example, a swift expansion of forward contracting and the development of futures contracts extending beyond 1 year, perhaps as long as two or even beyond that. And to illustrate the interest in this possibility, the Soviet Minister of Foreign Trade, Mr. Patalichev, not too long ago told me that the Soviet Union is interested in multi-year supply and price contracting for soybeans as well as other grains. Now, our futures market is not adjusted to multi-year contracts, but they have the capacity, we have the know-how, and I'm sure a response will occur. Now, if instead of staying out of the warehousing business, the U.S. government gets back in and gets back into the business of buying and storing grain with the objective of price and supply management, the favorable developments that I have mentioned, of course, are not apt to happen, and if they do, certainly not on the scale that would otherwise occur. Heavy government holdings, inevitably controlled by political factors, not economics, would in that case again hang over the market to the disadvantage, I believe, of farmers, consumers, and taxpayers. Anytime the government owns large stocks of grains, it controls agricultural prices to a substantial degree. And that concerns farmers. That concerns farmers because they know that no matter what the politicians promise, when there are 200 million consumers shouting about high food prices, they make a lot more noise than 3 million farmers. A good example is the export embargo that was placed on soybeans not too long ago. Another is the freeze on beef prices. And we all saw the disastrous effects that had on the livestock industry. The only effective way, at least the most effective way, to encourage farmers to full production to meet the world food requirements is to remove the apprehension that they naturally feel whenever the government has the ability adversely to affect market prices. Frankly, I have grave misgivings about the wisdom or lack thereof of the federal government ever engaging substantially in supply management stockpiling. And I distinguish supply management stockpiling from the establishment of a famine relief grain reserve. In any case, our primary purpose in this era, at this stage, should be policies that will give farmers maximum incentive for production and confidence to move ahead. Now, secondly, I urge that we stop calling for export-import controls. Foreign markets are vital to American agriculture, and certainly to the broad interest of the American people. To keep these foreign markets, to expand them, to enable us to have the wherewithal in foreign markets with which to buy petroleum products and other things we need. We must treat contracts with foreign interests with the same consideration as we treat contracts here at home. We did not do that in the case of soybean meal to our near disaster, and it caused Japan and other interests to start looking for more dependable sources of supply. And third, let's drop the eat less meat theme. I hope Senator Humphrey and Lester Brown won't be offended by what I say. But conjecture about the desirability of eating less hamburger and other meat has the same adverse effect on producer confidence and market prices as price freezes and talk of price rollbacks. It's bound to damage confidence of the producer. Let me be more specific. If the American people are persuaded to eat less meat, the present financial difficulties of beef and pork producers will certainly be multiplied. Senator Humphrey and I both recently voted for legislation to guarantee credit for livestock producers, and obviously so they can stay in business and keep producing meat. And I find it a little bit difficult to reconcile that vote with the suggestion that each American eat one less hamburger each week. If meat consumption goes down, inevitably so will livestock prices. This in turn will force down the price of cheese, poultry, eggs, and soybeans, as well as feed grains. An Eat Less Meat program that is successful will hit hard the agricultural interests of every single state represented here today. How much? Let me illustrate with a few statistics. Eating less meat would adversely affect 78% of all farm receipts in Minnesota, 85% of all farm receipts in Iowa, 71% of all farm receipts in Illinois, 82% of all farm receipts in the state of Missouri, 82% in South Dakota, and 74% in Nebraska. Now, it's true that the consumer in giving up one hamburger a week really wouldn't be making much of a sacrifice. In fact, in a sense, he might be a little bit better off without the extra calories. But the real loser is the rancher, the feeder, the feed grain producer, the feed mill operator, and anybody else whose livelihood depends upon the prosperity of those elements in our economy. If instead of giving up a hamburger, the citizen will donate a dollar a week or more to CARE, to Catholic Relief, to CROP, or to a similar charitable program, he will make a significant and immediate contribution to starving people without causing a long chain of undesirable side effects. The best way to assure an adequate supply of food in the years ahead is to rest our confidence on the strength of our own private marketing system and let it function. Let it continue to provide the kind of incentives that will expand the productive limits of American agriculture. And if we want a promising view of how far these productive limits of American agriculture can be expanded, I urge you to read a statement made to the House Committee on Agriculture just this past week by Don Paarlberg, the chief economist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Tremendous prospects for expansion of our productive capacity. So we have it here. And other countries have the capacity to expand food production too. And that's why, at the same time, while we deal with the forces of the competitive private market here to meet our own needs, I think it's very vital that we help these developing countries begin to build the same type sound foundation for food supply in their own countries.
Our next panelist is Lester Brown. Lester R. Brown is a senior fellow in the Overseas Development Council. He is an agricultural economist and highly regarded. He was administrator of the International Agricultural Development Service for the United States Department of Agriculture. He was selected one of the 10 outstanding young men of America by the USJCs in 1965. Lester Brown has been outstanding in the areas of increased food production. His work in the area of food crisis in India was widely recognized. He is an author, and some of his works are In the Human Interest, World Without Borders, Seeds of Change in Man, Land and Food.
In 10 minutes, one cannot present an analysis of the food problem. One can only touch on a few points. I would like to suggest, as one who's just finished writing a book, An Overview of the World Food Situation, that the complexity of the world food problem may now exceed our analytical capability. Let me repeat that. The complexity of the world food problem may now exceed our analytical capability. In order to understand what is happening in the world food economy, one today must be at once an economist, ecologist, agronomist, meteorologist, and political scientist. These at a minimum. And very few of us, either in government or in universities, are trained to analyze problems in a multidisciplinary fashion. Our record, those of us who spend our time trying to analyze and understand what's happening in the world food economy, our record has not been very good in the last few years. Let me cite just a few of the areas where we have fallen short in our analysis. The world fish catch, which is roughly equivalent to world beef output in terms of protein supply, had increased each year for 20 years from 1950 to 1970, and the catch was projected to continue growing for the indefinite future. And then suddenly it turned down in 1971, down again in 72, and down further in 73. A 20-year trend reversed itself, and there were very, very few people who anticipated that reversal. Second point. The Economic Research Service of the Department of Agriculture, now headed by Quentin West and with which I was earlier associated, early last year predicted a rise in food prices in the United States of 3%. It turned out to be closer than 20%. And this is an organization with, despite this, some of the finest agricultural economists in the world. As I recall, Quentin, 575 in total, at least there used to be that many, maybe no longer. This is not a marginal miss. The difference between 3 and 20% is not marginal. That's a very substantial miss. A third area. The political analyst did not anticipate the change in Soviet policy in 1972, which caused them to decide that rather than to ask consumers to tighten belts after a shortfall in the wheat crop, they decided to import and to offset the shortfall in that way. We knew that the Soviet political establishment was becoming more responsive to consumer needs, but we completely missed that major change in policy and the impact it's had on the world food economy. In 1970, not one agricultural analyst in 100, perhaps not one in 1,000, would have anticipated that by 1974, we would have had all of our 50 million acres of idled cropland back in production, not only back in production, but with it all in production, still hanging on by our fingertips, and still apparently unable to rebuild the depleted world food reserves. I cite these as a few. I could go on until lunchtime, citing the important areas where agricultural analysts, where we as a group have failed to anticipate major global shifts in the world food economy. There are many ways of viewing the food economy. I mentioned at least five disciplines that bear on how we view the problem. We could view it as economists in the very simplest terms. The traditional response of those of us in the economic profession to the problem of potential food scarcity has been, don't worry about food scarcity. If food becomes scarce, prices will rise, and that will induce additional production. Quite so. But what we did not anticipate was the effect it would have on the demand side. And again, not one agriculturalist in 100 in 1970 would have believed that world wheat prices could have tripled in a period of 18 months, or that world soybean prices could have tripled in a period of 18 months. But it's happened. We did not look at the demand side and the impact of these increases on consumption patterns. But for those who are whose incomes are $100, $200 a year, those in the fourth world, already spending 80% of their income on food, as the price of wheat, soybeans, rice has doubled or tripled, they simply have not been able to adjust. And what we are now beginning to see in country after country, in Central America, in Sub-Saharan Africa, in the Indian subcontinent, is rising death rates. Rising death rates, reversing a 20-year decline of declining death rates, reduced infant mortality, now beginning to turn up. Nutrition Institute in Central America reporting a dramatic increase in the incidence of severe protein malnutrition, particularly among young children. We did not anticipate that. Another way of looking at the world food problem is to look at it in terms of physical resources. The basic resources used to expand food production are land, water, energy, fertilizer. None of these can be described as being abundant today. Most of the good land in the world is now under the plow. Most of the easy irrigation projects have been completed. Those that will be undertaken in the future will be more costly, much more difficult to undertake, much more complex in engineering terms. Energy. We do not yet know what the impact of a tripling of the world price of energy will have on future food production prospects and trends. We do know it will not be positive. We know that an agricultural system such as our own is heavily dependent on energy. Our enormous rates of productivity, which have been referred to earlier, and of which we can be justly proud, which are unique in global terms, depend on the very intensive use of energy. We think of the energy used in agriculture in terms of the fuel that goes into the tractors. But recent analyses of the energy use in agriculture in the Midwest, in Corn Belt agriculture, shows that the principal source of energy now used in food production in the Midwest is not the fuel that operates the equipment that does the plowing, the planting, the cultivating, the harvesting, but it's in the form of nitrogen fertilizer. The energy equivalent of nitrogen fertilizer is now greater than all the energy used in the farm equipment. Beyond this, if we look at the total U.S. food system, beginning with the inputs coming into the farm and following all the way through to the dining room table, we discover that only 1/4 of all the energy used in that system is used up to the farm gate. 3/4 of the energy is used in transporting, processing, distributing the food from the farm gate to the dining room table. The grossest source of inefficiency in that system is the use of a 2-ton vehicle in the form of a family car to transport not more than 30 pounds of food from a supermarket to home at least once a week, sometimes making several trips per week. In engineering terms, that is a gross inefficiency. A recent analysis in Science magazine points out that if the world were one to move to the American-type diet by the end of the century, and two, to move to the energy-intensive form of highly productive agriculture that we have in North America, that known world reserves of petroleum would be exhausted in 29 years. That's just agriculture. That's not everything between the farm gate and the dining room table. Now, the world's not going to move to the American-type diet. We know that, and the world's not going to move to the same type of agriculture we have. But this does dramatize the extent to which future food production prospects and hopes for improving diets are dependent on energy supplies. One of the things that disturbs me most about the energy crisis, and it's particularly its relationship to agriculture, is our failure to understand what is happening in the world energy economy and how it is going to affect us. There's no question but that there is a leadership vacuum in this area now. We, because of our inefficiencies in the use of petroleum are in the process of mortgaging our country to the oil exporting countries in the Middle East. 2 months ago, I spent a weekend with a group of UN people and various other specialists concerned with food and energy and resource scarcity in a retreat outside New York City. One of the participants in that conference was Dr. Khan, spelled K-H-E-N-E, who is the Secretary General of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. He's an Algerian by nationality, a medical doctor by training. And during the course of that conference, he again and again made the point that we need to think about energy conservation. After hearing him make this comment for a few times, I asked him, what do you think would be a desirable energy policy for the United States? Should we continue on the trend we've been on since the end of World War II, consuming more and more energy, doubling the use every 10 or a dozen years or whatever it is? Or do you think we should try to level off and stabilize our use of energy through conservation? He said, I don't think I would recommend either of those policies for the United States. He said, I think you should reduce absolutely, in absolute terms, the amount of energy you're using. He said, you have gross inefficiencies now woven into your entire economic system, in transportation, in housing, in manufacturing, where you use far more energy than is needed, and in my mind, he said, in a very wasteful way. He said, I think that should be corrected. We are beginning to see the consequences of the enormous pileup of capital in the Middle East in countries which cannot spend that capital internally. And so they are beginning to invest abroad. Within a decade, the Middle East countries will be able to invest abroad 10 times as much capital as the United States now has invested overseas. We're beginning to see it take form and to see what it's going to look like. Iran last week purchased 1/4 interest in and control of Krupp Industries in Germany. Krupp, you'll recognize as the major steel, heavy equipment, arms producer in Germany throughout most of this century. Now 1/4 controlled by the Iranians and with Iranians sitting on the board of directors. Company after company may go this way unless we begin to recognize that energy conservation across the board is now in our national interest. What do we do about the food problem? As a result of the analysis in the book referred to by Secretary Humphrey, which will be off the press in September, by Bread Alone, I am reasonably convinced that the solution to the food problem, by that I mean an adequate minimum supply of food to people everywhere, is no longer something that farmers can determine. That is to say, I think to the extent that a workable solution, that a humane solution to the food population problem exists, it now exists on the population side of the equation. Unless we can put the brakes on population growth in a way that most of us in the world have not thought of heretofore, I don't think there is any acceptable solution to the food population problem. As now projected, world population is to increase to 10 to 16 billion sometime during the latter part of the next century. We're now approaching 4 billion. I don't think we can realistically support that many people. It's not that the physical potential doesn't exist, it's the stresses, the ecological stresses, the resource scarcities, the stresses on the international monetary and political system that we must concern ourselves with. We're not talking about a problem that's going to unfold several years from now or around the end of the century. We're talking about a problem that now exists and is very likely going to become much worse before it becomes better. One of the inputs required in agriculture is fertilizer. Fertilizer is in short supply. This year, the principal exporting countries, the United States, those countries in Western Europe and Japan, who export fertilizer, who have been, in one way or another, restricting exports. This has had a profound effect on agriculture in Asia. Asia is experiencing a major and massive shortage of fertilizer. Almost every major country is affected. Based on what we now know, about the availability of fertilizer in Asia for the 1974 crop, we can say with some confidence that the next harvest will be less than the last. And this is independent of weather. We can say that the food deficit in Asia in 1975 will be the largest in the history of Asia, in the history of any region in the world. We can say that with a disturbing degree of confidence, even now, before the returns on the monsoon are in. Coming at a time when reserves are at a modern low, this will present some very difficult political and moral questions. Given the fact that the principal food reserve in the world today is no longer stocks or surpluses of grain, but exists in the form of expanded livestock herds in this country, in Europe, in the Soviet Union, the only important source of flexibility we have is in adjusting on that front. What we may discover by the end of this year and the early months of 1975 is that political leaders in the more affluent countries will have to decide whether, in effect, to cast Asia adrift with its vast food deficit, or whether political leaders will go to the people, as in this country, and ask for the equivalent of turning thermostats down 6 degrees on the food front. Skip a meal a week, one meatless day a week, or what have you. I think we're going to be faced with a very difficult political and moral question because we do not have the reserves. Indeed, we do not have a reserve policy in the United States. One of the issues that will loom large as we approach the food conference in Rome will be whether or not the international community is capable of cooperating and creating, of fashioning both a global food reserve policy and building stocks, not only in exporting countries, but in importing countries as well, for they must share this responsibility. It is not only a matter of food supply, though that's the way we tend to view it in the Department of Agriculture. It is much more than that. It's a matter of economic stability. It's a matter of political stability. We've moved into, as a result of the tripling of world food and energy prices, a period of great instability, a period of inflation, two-digit inflation, virtually uncontrollable. Early this year, I made the point that probably 10 to 15 governments around the world would change hands in 1974 as a result of these economic instabilities that would affect political situation. As of mid-1974, that is now clearly a very conservative estimate. I would point out to you that every major government in Western Europe has changed hands since January 1st. France, Italy, Britain, Germany, not to mention several smaller ones, Belgium, Netherlands, Portugal, etc. If there was any government that I thought would have been immune to these new forces, it would have been the government of Canada. Canada, an exporter of both energy and of food. And yet, we saw the Trudeau government bite the dust a few months ago on a vote of no confidence. We must view the food problem not in narrow terms, but in broad global terms, in terms of efforts to create a stable world economy, a workable international monetary system. Because if that system collapses, we've had it. We've had it. We went through that once before. I can barely remember the last years of the Depression. But we're in a very precarious situation in the world economy today. Norman Borlaug has been traveling extensively throughout the world and looking at the impact of the monetary situation, the availability of energy and fertilizer on food production. He is deeply disturbed by the impact on other countries of the lack of leadership anywhere in the world. Traditionally, the world has looked to the United States for leadership in time of difficulty, whether it was World War II or post-war reconstruction or the food crisis in India in the mid-60s. The world is not getting that leadership today. If we can't lead, who will? Thank you.
Norman E. Borlaug, a man whose name is well known around the world for his research at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center since 1964. For his many accomplishments in plant breeding, Dr. Borlaug was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. He has served as a consultant to Latin American, African, and Asian governments, and has been awarded more than 20 academic and scientific awards. Dr. Borlaug is recognized, as we know internationally, as the foremost authority on the subject of food supply for the world.
I think I should first, although it should be apparent, clarify the point of view from which I speak. I've lived outside of the United States for 30 years, working on these food production problems, and almost without exception in food deficit nations, struggling with the problem of trying to do something about increasing their productivity, in trying to train young scientists so that they themselves can take over and assume more responsibility for increasing the food production capacities of these nations. It's been implied, but it hasn't been stated. So I would just like to reflect a minute on the great concern that has been expressed here in the USA by the non-rural or non-farm sectors in the past 2 years as food prices have soared. I would hurry to point out also that it is not only here, but this same concern, as Dr. Brown has just pointed out, has affected other nations of the world, the nations that are large food importers, even more gravely. If we look back to the end of World War II, when these so-called stocks or surpluses were held by the grain exporting nations, they in effect were buffers on world food prices from the standpoint of the consumer. They were also a dampening effect from the standpoint of doing injustices, I'm sure I'm fair to say, to the farmers, especially the small farmers in the grain exporting nations. This all was adjusted, presumably gradually over many years of time, so that production capacity in the exporting nations could be brought into better harmony with the abilities of the importing nations to absorb this production. It was thought through various devices, and they were different in different countries, our own being somewhat different than the Canadian and the Australian. And I should say in those early years, Australia or Argentina was also an important exporter, but became less so because of internal political difficulties, economic policies that didn't stimulate production. Yet this was all sort of missed by the vast urban populations, the non-rural sectors. They thought it took very little to produce food. Everyone knew it came out of the supermarkets, and so very little attention was really given to agriculture. It didn't receive its due emphasis, and I assure you that governors, that this was beyond your immediate controls or beyond the control of the federal government. It just was a reality of life. As someone said a few minutes ago, 3% of the people, or 4%, I believe it was you, Congressman Finley, produced the food. That small sector is forgotten. Now, amazingly, you would think it would be different in the developing nations, because there you will find 50, 60, 70, or 80% of the people living on the land, producing the food. But there also the policy to stimulate agriculture and consequently to increase their production has almost without exception been given very secondary importance. And it's been a constant fight, even after one has developed certain technology that has been tested a long distance, in this particular case where I've been involved in wheat production, developed in Mexico, tested and found out to be applicable in halfway around the world in certain countries, many countries, but let me use the case of India to illustrate that when you see light under the door, when you see that you can make a conspicuous breakthrough, the greatest difficulty of all is to convince planners, political leaders, and all too often scientists themselves. that this breakthrough is at hand, to bring about the right economic policies that will permit the implementation of this new technology. It has been frustrating all too often, and yet at certain times there has been conspicuous and really large change. I have seen, for example, India's wheat production in the short period of time from 68 to 1973 go from about 420 million bushels to a billion bushels, making it during that short period until it fell into this fertilizer energy crisis, the third largest producer of wheat in the world. Probably a faster change than has ever taken place anywhere else in the world in any given crop, at least a crop of that magnitude of size. There has been promising changes in some of these other countries. But now as we look at what has happened just in the last 2 years, there are many depressing, discouraging things that enter into the picture. I should say at this point that in order to appreciate the magnitude of the problem that we're dealing with, I would like to paint it in this way. We thought that we had adjusted our production to what international markets could consume. By 1971, it was also thought that the grain exporting countries, who had been the brokers, warehouses, and bankers, unjustly, for carrying the world food reserves at their own expense, the expense of their taxpayers, had brought this into balance that they thought was adequate, with an adequate reserve to meet any emergency by the end of 1971. That was an all-time harvest of cereal grains. It amounted to 1,100,000,000 metric tons. And you see, I've been in the metric system so long, I have difficulties of changing back to millions or billions of bushels. But I think if I express it this way, it's the equivalent, that 1971 harvest, to a highway built of grain that goes around the earth at the equator. This highway will be 55 feet wide, and it will have a roadbed that will be 6 feet deep. That's how much grain was produced in 1971. But since we are 76 million more people each year, and this is why one has to be very cautious when we talk about looking forward into the future, very far, the growing needs. 76 million more people, which means about 2% world population growth. But the consumption is going up, as Dr. Brown has indicated, closer to 2.5% in consumption of cereal grains. That means 27 million more tons of grain every year, a billion bushels more grain every year. So we have to rebuild this highway of grain every year, or the highway around the equator, and then start building and construct on a second highway at the rate of 625 miles a year, a highway of that same dimension, just to keep per capita cereal grain production at the same level. This doesn't take into consideration many of the other items that we have to have, soybeans and beans and legumes of all kinds, vegetables and fruits and fibers. So it's a tremendous magnitude of challenge. I think Dr. Brown mentioned that our food habits, Senator Humphrey also mentioned this. We are beef eaters in the US as well as in much of the Western world. And this means that you convert, especially animals that go through the feedlots, 8 or 9 pounds of grain to each pound of prime beef that's produced. And the conversion is also high, even in other animals such as pork and or swine and poultry, but if not the same magnitude. A pound or a metric ton of grain here with our food habits will feed about, we consume nearly a ton per person here and in Canada, mostly in the form of animal products, meat, cheese, eggs, so on. That same ton of grain in India with their food habits will feed 5 people for a year. So you see what habits are has a lot to do with the demands for grain. We should point out that food habits are tricky sorts of things. In the rice-growing areas of the world, if you come from Japan or areas that have grown that kind of rice, you want the sticky cooking rices, and you don't want the dry cooking Indian rices. If you come from South Asia, it's just the opposite. And I dare say in one of the most unpleasant experiences that we had in introduction of Mexican wheats into India in the early stages was a little thing called color of grain. They wanted white. The ordinary consumer didn't care, wasn't concerned about this. But some people that manipulated the market were deeply concerned, and if they could get an extra 20% out of depressing prices on grain of red color, this was too often done. And governments weren't realistic and tough enough to see that these abuses were brought under control. Of course, the irony of that was that during the same period when we were trying to get this moving, or shortly there before, the U.S. exported and Canada into India about 400 million tons of or bushels of red grain, what was being complained about in the markets. So you see there's some very funny things that have to do with food habits that are built into the different systems in different parts of the world. Now, I would like to say that our dilemma at the moment is that there are no grain reserves of any substance anywhere in the world. We're short of fertilizer, as has already been pointed out. If this monsoon fails in South Asia in the rice crop, God help us all. Because without that reserve, even did the grain exist to move in, let us say, 10 million metric tons through the ports and the railroad systems, or perhaps 15, into Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan, were it available, is practically an impossibility on a crash program basis. There are transport problems as well. I have traveled the last 5 months in 20 different countries, not only traveled, worked and struggled and prodded and pushed and all of the other unpleasantries that go with this kind of a job, in trying to encourage production. And take the case of India. We think that we had unpleasantries here in the energy crisis. I would like to point out what happened to one country which typifies the situation in perhaps 25 different countries, all of which are petroleum importers, have none of their own, fertilizer importers, and food importers. On those three items for importations in 1971, India spent about $570 million. If it were to import those same quantities today, it would be about $1.25 billion. But this is an impossibility because there's no fertilizer. And if it were available, it's just not there. But since they've had to cut back on their crude oil imports, which is the raw material also for their nitrogenous fertilizer, they get in a bind on that front. So that by cutting back on fertilizer imports, they will have to increase the imports probably by 5 to 10 million tons of grain, which is ruinous with the prices the way they are now on the international market and with their lack of foreign exchange. This would cost them somewhere between close to $3 billion, and if they cut out all fertilizer imports and cut back more on their crude oil importations, it will go up towards $4 billion. Their economy is in ruins. And this is true of more than one, as I say, probably 10 or 15 countries. The neighbors to the south throughout Central America are in the same fix, and there are many others in Asia and Africa. So when we complain about what happened to us with the energy crisis, we need to have a long, close look at what's happened to the cleavage of the third world nations into those who have petroleum for export and those who don't. It's two different worlds on that front, too, at the present time. Now, in closing, I would just like to say that I will have to disagree, looking at this as a world citizen, with some of the seeming different points of view about the depressing effect of prices of reserves, wherever they may be in the world, on the price of farmers' product, in other words, grain prices. We have to make one decision. And I would urge you all not to urge our own government to again assume the full responsibility, together with that of Canada and Australia, financing this whole storage as was done in the past, but that industrial nations have a stake in this also. They're suffering from the increases in food prices, whether it's Germany or Japan. And they too have to take a part of this responsibility. However this be organized, there has to be a reserve. We are in the ridiculous position now with no reserves, shortage of fertilizer, and everywhere I go, I see less than the rosy picture that has been painted of the world cereal grain production at the present time. India's production on wheat will be down certainly 200 million bushels. Their rice may be worse because the fertilizer shortage is growing worse. The unconfirmed reports, and therein also is one of our great difficulties, on statistics from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe are unreliable. They arrive late. They may be biased in favor of forthcoming decisions, economic decisions. And this is a poor way to plan for the food of 3.8 billion people in this world. If we do not have information from the centrally controlled governments of the USSR, the People's Republic of China, and also from some of the Eastern European countries, then how, which represent more than a third of the world population, how can we do a very good job of trying to plan what production needs are? There has to be better communication. There has to be some arrangements made for sustaining a reasonable reserve and isolating it from the market. I'm not an economist, but there must be some way of doing this so that you don't depress the price of grain and that the United States, again, does not carry a disproportionate responsibility for carrying this economic burden. Now, I would simply say that I am deeply concerned, just as Dr. Brown is, about the social political instabilities in these countries. You cannot apply the new technology to expand food production if there's political and social chaos in a country. It goes from bad to worse. And I think we will see more of this in the next 2 or 3 years unless we can rebuild some semblance of reserve to protect against a drought such as we are experiencing in some areas here in the U.S. at the present time. I have seen these unconfirmed reports that, again, the wheat crop is not good in USSR. Try to get accurate information, you can't. There was reported winter kill in the eastern European countries on winter wheat. Again, try to get accurate information, it isn't there. And then remember always what Dr. Brown mentioned about how we grow in numbers and how we must provide for these people. Since you began your conference yesterday morning, there are now 216,000 additional people that have to be provided for, not only in food, but for all of the other basic necessities of life. And since I've been up here talking, there are about 1,800 more, so I better sit down before it gets worse.